Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet Michael Jennings. Jennings is a graduate of both the University of Pennsylvania and the writing program at Syracuse University. He has been published in many literary journals and magazines, including the Georgia Review, the Southern Review, and Yellow Medicine. He is the author of 7 collections of poetry, including his most recent collection called Bone Songs and Sanctuaries, New and Selected Poems. It was published by Sheep Meadow Press. And welcome to the show, Michael. It's nice to see you here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Now, let's begin with the beginning. According to your bio, you were born in New Orleans, grew up in East Texas and the deserts of southwestern Iran. Tell us about this childhood and if it's the thing that provoked you to become a writer.
Well, I was born in the French Quarter of New Orleans. I was originally raised by my mother and my grandmother. My mother had to run away at a certain point from my grandmother and took me to Beaumont, Texas, where she met my stepfather, who worked for, it was then Saucony Mobil, but Mobil Oil. When I was 9, we went to Iran, where I spent my formative years.
Wow. What was that like? Did you start writing when you were a kid? How did that
no,
start?
No, I was an athlete. I played racket sports primarily. I used to break and train race horses. I had the fastest horse in South Iran. Really, I thought tennis would be my career. But the summer before I started college, I had been recruited for squash and tennis. I had a motorcycle accident in France that kept me in the hospital for a year.
Oh, my goodness.
Which I spent listening to Bob Dylan, kind of turning the world on its head. And that's when I made the transition from physical art to word arts.
So in some ways it was an accident or a sickness that got you into writing. I've heard that a lot from writers.
Because you have
that time for that solitary thinking, I suppose.
And I've always thought, with some exceptions, to be a poet, something has to knock you off your trolley, and the motorcycle accident did that.
Yeah, and when you first started writing, were you writing about your accident? Was it mainly self?
No, I just knew I wanted to write. I had sort of heard Dylan Thomas when I was in high school on record, and when I got to the University of Pennsylvania, I began taking poetry courses. But it was a couple of years before I discovered the Iranian landscape as a subject, and I stayed with that for a long time.
Mm-hmm. So that life in another world did come out finally in poetry.
It did finally come out, yes.
Now, what is it that you're striving for when you write poetry? Are you striving for the universal, or are you just trying to put your own experiences into a new language?
Well, what I'm trying to do is get under the skin of experience. I'm very right-brained, very pattern-perceiving, and sometimes I think that poetry is a kind of right-brained sensibility or realization worked into a left-brain form language.
So the right brain is conceiving it, but the left brain is writing it down ultimately?
Right.
Oh, what an interesting way of thinking of it. So tell us what that means to you, though. Are you thinking in lines or patterns, or...
I mostly think in pictures.
Mm.
You know, poems come a lot of different ways, but, you know, occasionally I get a line or something, but often I see something or I remember something, and then I try to find a language that's sort of tonally right and make it into a sort of portrait of that vision.
Mm-hmm.
When I was first considering being a poet, I realized, you know, I'd started drawing a lot, and the visual arts kind of control space, music, time, and I realized poems could sort of control both because it's kind of musical painting.
Oh, absolutely. At its best, it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I want you to read from your latest collection, Bone Songs and Sanctuaries. This is a poem called Diffusions of August, and I'd like you to begin with that one. Do you want to tell us about it, or would you rather read it first?
Well, no, this is kind of an Ars Poetica poem. It's sort of about how being a poet is kind of generic. When you go into a poem, you sort of invite all the poets you've known that are walking around in your head to join you. So it's kind of about that. and about the present moment of the poem that is the thing the poet goes after, and then eventually when the poem is done, it's past tense.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got a couple of lifted lines from Robert Lowell and Louis Simpson. Diffusions of August. Somewhere I think there lurks a poem today, aching perhaps on the horizon, or in the lost last blue sky of summer. I stay indoors and spoil another season, wrote the old master, searching the moment within a moment when the present fades, and there is only the present, to walk forth crippled thereafter. Bless us with this curse, lisp the thick leaves with their fat shadows, sibyls of midnight, silvery wombs of the morning. The spidery breeze on my face has come its thousand miles. The tall trees honor me. I walk among mountains and know the angels' names. I drag my lame foot and feel the beggar's shame. They want me to wear old clothes, not walk in the painted sunshine, but live in the tragic world. Hail to thee, dark talkers, shakers of leaves, whispering still in the soft air, in the lazy air, as insects rattled in the golden blaze when the poem got made.
Oh, that's beautiful, Michael. You read beautifully, too. Wonderful, wonderful. You know what I want to ask you? I often think that people who write poetry, especially such as the one that you just read, are somewhat haunted by the past. Do you feel that when
you're
writing?
Well, I remember Seamus Heaney was asked where his poems came from, and he said it's always memory. With me, it's not always memory, but I do think I was blessed or cursed with an extraordinary memory of my young life. I remember a lot. And I think haunted is sort of right, that the past asks to have its say in the present.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well put, yeah. Because I sense that from so many poets, mm-hmm. that they're trying to, instead of let the past suck them up, they try to present it in a form that's more
beautiful,
perhaps.
Well, I think
perhaps.
There's that freeing, too, mm-hmm. that once you can make it into a poem, it no longer owns you, you know.
No, I understand that. I do. I want to ask you about reading poetry aloud. Does that change the essence of a poem, to read it aloud? And do you think that's an important aspect of writing, to think about it as something being read aloud?
I believe in the theory that a poem on paper is the equivalent of a score, that it indicates the timing and something of the tonality of a sound in the air. And I'm a little bit rare, I think, among contemporary American poets in the primacy I give the oral experience. That has partly to do with the fact that I was dyslexic. I could never read out loud in class anything. So when I took to poetry, I just memorized dozens of poems. Auden had said when he started his poetry school in heaven, they would do nothing but memorize poems. So I took him at his word. And I tend to compose my poems more than write them.
So are you reading them out loud as you're writing them, and then it becomes
I'm at least babbling them. My wife says it's a little like living with a monk. but that's how I work them out. And usually when I finish a poem, I simply know it by heart. And for years, I always just recited my poems. I've reached an age where I don't always trust myself to just recite them, but...
Mm-hmm. Do you think the meanings change when you recite them? I've had a lot of visual artists, and they say they don't like to interpret their work. But poets are interpreting their work.
For me, when I recite it, I rediscover the poem. That I know it sort of as a system of sounds. And if I recite it, I recover it. If I just read it, sometimes I lose that quality, though I'm learning to do a little of both.
Uh-huh, Well, I want you to read another piece from Bone Songs and Sanctuaries. This one's called Nightwood, and I find this one absolutely gorgeous. It's one of my favorites of yours. You want to tell us a little bit about it?
Well, this, you know, I remember Elizabeth Bishop once said, I heard her read, and that all her poems were true stories. This is a true story. I'm not sure all my poems are true story, but this just happened when I moved into the house I live in now, which is, you know, out in the country, and there are lots of deer. But I raised dogs, which, you know, at first kept the deer a little distance. But I went out one night, and I could tell they knew there was something in the trees, though I couldn't see it.
Mm.
And that led to this poem, Nightwood. The dogs tell me they've come. A skin crawling, fur bristling, alert, faces in the moonlight, statuary stillness, pressuring a slight yelp from the youngest. Something come down in the midnight, from behind the hill's eyelid, travels with the patience of the blind, browses and peers in at us with unearthly eyes, as though the lights of our house were hellfire guarded by wolves, a terror that lures them out of slow-chewing sidelong glances, flickering uncertainty, sudden hoof-thump, oaken vigilance, something more near than heartbeat, but older, antlered, waist-deep in the sky-deep blackness, ghosts older than the Iroquois, turned back into trees by the dawn.
Oh, that's beautiful. And I find that a real haunting piece. It's great. Really beautiful. Well, I was going to bring up the fact that you raise and breed dogs. What is it about dogs that have captured you?
Well, when I was
you?
In Iran, I had lots of dogs, and I used to race and train racehorses. And when you move as much as I didn't really live any place for more than 2 years till I went to boarding school. I think there's a tendency to want to hold on to pieces of your past. And the connection to the animal was sort of sacred to me. And when I was a senior in high school, my dorm master had a Siberian Husky puppy, who I just thought was the most magical animal I had ever seen. So in college, I got my first one, and I gradually became a breeder. And I eventually wrote 3 books on the breed.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I judge them around the world and show them.
Uh-huh. And then you obviously are inspired by them, right?
Well, they
you
are.
Write a lot about them.
Well, they're the closest things to wolves that I think one can own. One should not own wolves, but all dogs are wolves. They're just modified for the things we want them to do. To develop a sled dog, you don't have to modify a wolf very much. So they maintain really primitive characteristics in their social interaction, so on. So they're kind of endlessly fascinating.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's a way for a poet to get in touch with the wild and
exactly,
his or herself.
Exactly. Well, it also came from the fact that I was spending a lot of time in kind of hyper-verbal graduate student lounges, and I longed for the silence of the animal.
Ah.
So I could go back with my dogs and be quiet.
Uh-huh. And then eventually you would howl, which would
become
a poem.
Right, exactly.
I
do think of poems as kind of wolf howls. I mean, I think Bone Songs and Sanctuaries, that's sort of what I had in mind, that they are a way of reaching out to whatever it is. The sacred,
the vast,
the
mystery.
Magical. Right, right.
Yeah, oh, interesting, interesting. Well, what do you think about poets being put into categories? You know, we always hear Snyder and Ginsberg are part of the Beats. Do you think that's a good or bad thing for poets to be put into categories?
Well, you know, the synthetic imagination, which I think poets need, is exactly the opposite of the analytical. I cannot keep file cabinets because eventually everything goes into one drawer. Categorizing poets that way doesn't accomplish much for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in how they get to words, what they do with the language. I suppose a certain amount of categorization is useful. You know what box to put them in or to bring them out if you're teaching. But I've just never gotten categories very much.
If you're just joining us, my guest is the poet Michael Jennings. We're talking about, and he's reading from his book, Bone Songs and Sanctuaries. Now, do you believe strongly or not strongly about writing from your experience? Or, you know, I read an interview with Philip Levine where he said he tells his students, why be yourself if you can be somebody interesting, you know? And he says he makes up things, like even sisters and brothers and families in his poems.
I think it depends on what kind of writer you are and where you are in your evolution. In some ways, we adopt masks that are perhaps our opposite selves or our
ideal selves, perhaps.
Or something. But for me, writing from experience is the way I went. I can certainly see writing from some much more arbitrary standpoint. But I do believe in authenticity, what James Dickey called the handprint of necessity. And for me, I can measure or sense the authenticity more if it's something close to home. I do feel there has to be something at stake in a poem.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. I want you to read another from Bone Songs, and this one is called Cow Skull, and I find this one fascinating as well. Yeah. You want to tell us a bit about it?
Well, this is probably the oldest poem in the book. This was when I was first writing poems about the Iranian landscape. I was just doing sort of little windows into that world, and I was sort of obsessed with this image of myself out in the desert and seeing the town from a long way off in a kind of mythic way that is shadowy to me now, but I think maybe it comes through in the poem. Cow Skull. This is the land's death mask, the splintered face into which Earth's bodiless distances bulldoze to a halt, the great brain ousted by wasp nest, sagebrush thrust from the caved nostrils. You would think, staring into the round, gaping eye, that nothing could have died so utterly. On the horizon, the stone town darkens and turns blue. Soon it, too, will fall to ruin, like the honed cheek of the cow's skull, turned to a husk in the evening air, while dry, bird-like men come picking their way homeward over the broken fields.
I love it. Have you gone back to Iraq since you were
no,
a child?
No, I haven't. I have a friend who is much older who comes and goes, and he called me from Iran, and I said, well, if I came there, would I be pretty safe? He said, oh, absolutely. If you're with me, you're fine. But then I thought about it. I do travel around the world judging dogs, and I thought, if I go to Iran and get that stamped on my passport, U.S. Customs is going to stop me for an hour every
Isn't
time I come.
Isn't sad
in.
That you have to think in those terms? That was your home.
Well, yeah, and I hope someday I'll make it back. But
it's still coming out in your imagination.
It does. You know, I try to leave it behind. I've tried to write poems that sort of ended, but that desert does come back.
And haunt you.
Yeah, it is haunting, the desert.
Yeah, well, the poems that you've written about it certainly seem to be. I wanted to ask you about the title of this collection, Bone Songs and Sanctuaries. That's a beautiful title. Well, what does Bone Songs actually mean to you?
Well, this was a title I gave to an early series of poems that I didn't do anything with. But when I collected these, that title stayed with me. I think of it, first of all, as sort of phallus and cave, the male-female principles, the sort of singing out that a poem is, but the sort of sanctuary also that a poem is. So it's that kind of yin-yang duality that I think I was trying to invoke.
Because when I saw the title, I thought of Bone Songs was he's writing about relics from his past.
Well, yes, and there is the song of the bone. And there are also flutes that can be made from bone and all of that.
And jewelry, all kinds
right,
of things.
Right, all sorts of things. So I just kind of wanted to invoke that conglomerate of associations.
Yeah, it's a beautiful title. I really like it. How do you react to critics? Have you had very many people writing about your poetry in a critical manner?
Not a lot. This book had four or five very nice reviews. I've never reached the level of prominence that people wanted to do me in, which I guess is, you know, it's a mixed bag.
So you'll know you've made it if you have to hide out.
Right. I'll know I made it if people are throwing stones at me. But
do you think you learn anything valid from people who are writing about your work? Because there's so much now. You know, there are blogs.
It always interests me what people say. Often it sort of surprises me. I learn probably more when I deal with a live audience and I see what poems are working or not working. Or I send my poems out to a handful of poet friends. And I live with my first critic and my wife, who I sort of trust absolutely.
Yeah.
Which is a nice thing, because most poets don't have that.
It's like that those that do, you know, that teach thing,
and those that don't are
critics.
Auden always had the wisest things to say. He said, there are people who are too intelligent to become authors, but they don't become critics.
Oh, that's an interesting way of putting it. Well, I do want to, before we run out of time, have you read a final piece from Bone Songs and Sanctuaries. This one is called Walking Wounded, Oakland, 1954. And this is from a collection influenced by Dorothea Lange's photography. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how you came upon that?
Well, I was looking for an escape from the Iranian landscape shortly after I was a graduate student. I had been writing about Iran and this sort of stony language, and I began to imagine a language that was a little prosier, and I thought, well, it's sort of the way an old black and white photograph might look, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the library, and I started looking through books of photographs until I found one that spoke to me. In a way, in retrospect, I think all of Dorothea Lange's photos of the Dust Bowl are really desert photos. So I think it was partly my way of importing my Iranian sensibility to witness America. It also has something to do with the fact that my father was a Depression child. I did know parts of Texas where she took many of her photos. So that's how they came to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I would just do one or two as a kind of experiment, but it turned into a book length. Well, there were 19 that were made into a book many years ago, and I used a handful of them as the sort of end of this book. This is called Walking Wounded, Oakland, 1954. There is a moment, albeit hypothetical, when something foreign passing through something familiar leaves only a blackness, a record of travel. Blood bulges and overruns the whole. And sometimes a scream flaps out from the first O of astonishment, the face gathering darkness like a hole that will never again get quite filled in. The man in this corridor is pure darkness, the forest floor. A black loam you could lie down in, dreaming of the long rays of sunlight that never come. It is a dream from which no one wakes. The man in this corridor intrudes almost not at all. A black shoulder, a black pant leg, a dead foot and thin line of black crutch angling from behind a telephone pole. There's no body, only darkness reshuffling. No face, only a meeting of moles holding silent parley in an unmarked grave. A city is closing on the man in this photograph. The telephone pole looks broad as a door, and the blank wall that is the whole right side of the picture looms somehow closer. It is washed whiter than any scar.
Wow, that's beautiful. I can understand why you were moved by some of her photographs. Her stuff is just, every time I see it, I almost like jump backwards because it's so stark.
Well, her aesthetic said that what she wanted from the viewer was not how was this photograph made, but a sense of wonder that such a thing could be.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, that's...
Yeah. Oh, I think you did an absolutely amazing job with trying to recreate that. On that note, I do want to ask you, because you do write poetry that tells stories. Have you ever thought about writing fiction?
I read a joke piece once about the difference between poets and fiction writers, and it said, you know, fiction writers are primarily interested in character, and it's not even clear whether poets know what character is. I'm interested in kind of cosmic things and that sacred universe that's every man. So specific character doesn't capture my imagination the way it does for, I think, real fiction writers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I loved Faulkner. I mean, to me, Faulkner kind of changed my life.
Yeah, and Faulkner's difficult for a lot of people who read straight fiction, right? It is almost like reading poetry for some people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I don't, so far I've never mustered either the discipline or the imagination. You have to know too much about too many worlds to make it real.
Uh-huh.
You know, a poem, you can just do a sort of snapshot. And
yeah, you can know so much about the world and just bring it into a little tiny space.
Right.
Tell us how you work. Do you try to write every day? Do you carry a pad around with you so you don't miss anything?
It's always changing, but poems often come to me in the car because I teach in two disparate campuses, so I have a fair amount of time in the car as sort of alone time. So sometimes poems occur to me there, and I start talking them out to myself. And when I catch up with a piece of paper and pencil, I write some of it down. Sometimes they come to me on my deck. I have a lovely porch overlooking Otisko Lake that's pretty inspirational. I can see far. I mean, that's one of the things that the desert did for me, is that I have a lust for being able to see far. When I went to New England to high school, everyone said, oh, isn't it beautiful? But you just kept seeing the next hill, and I, you know,
I
like to
see
far. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So where I live high up on a hill, I can overlook the whole lake, and so it's inspiring to me to be able to see far.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the ways poems tend to come, though every once in a while a phrase comes to me, or sometimes something happens, like the death of my mother or the death of a dog, that makes me say, I need to write a poem about that.
Yeah, I understand that.
So
we only have a minute left. What would you tell people who are, you know, aspiring to be writers about inspiration and what they should do?
Well, I think it always helps to read a lot, then follow your instincts. You know, it's good to get feedback, but I've always improved more by ignoring the feedback for a while, doing what I felt I needed to do despite what well-intentioned teachers were telling me.
Ah, good advice, I think. Well, Michael Jennings, we have almost run out of time. Do you have any contact information that you can give people? Website or anything?
Not really. I don't keep a website.
So there's no way for anybody to get in touch with you except for through your editor
or your publisher. Right.
Great. Well, the book again is called Bone Songs and Sanctuaries, and my guest has been Michael Jennings. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.